Welcome to KABU, Jennifer Ruth.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, Jan.
You're a professor in the School of Film and Associate Dean of the College of the Arts at Portland State University, and much of your scholarship focuses on controversies around academic freedom. You have several books on the topic, including The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right Wing Attack on Academic Freedom, a very timely volume, which will be coming out in early 2024. So it's delightful to have you on the OMO Variety Hour this morning to offer your insights on the drama that unfolded at a congressional hearing earlier this month. The presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the University of Pennsylvania, all women who were fairly new to their positions, were grilled during a 4-hour congressional hearing titled Holding Campus Leaders Accountable and Confronting Anti-Semitism. And assuming their call for accountability were directed to these three women presidents of prestigious universities in this country. And a wave of condemnations followed the hearing, with vociferous calls for their resignations. So, how would you describe what was happening at this congressional hearing? What were some of the political dynamics in play?
Well, it was very disturbing. It felt very much like political theater. It felt very much like echo of what we remember with the McCarthy hearings. And we're not yet at a point where a Claudine Gay can say, "Have you no decency?" Maybe in a few months, someone will be able to flip the tables a little bit and reframe things, or that's more in a more honest way.
There's a press for loyalty oaths.
Right now,
Very
there's not
short.
space for that, and there's not enough of a digestion of what's going on and an impatience with a kind of political interference that for some people sort of looks like we're sleepwalking into authoritarianism or even tyranny. But yeah, I mean, I think with the loyalty oaths, for one, the way that the entire hearings were framed, you know, if you're on campuses, you're hearing from students who are concerned about long-standing injustices in Gaza and the West Bank. Where you're hearing from students who have been thinking about boycott, divest, and sanctions, and who do see a parallel between the boycotting of universities around South African apartheid and the segregation and the cordoning off and the sort of surveillance state that Israel has over it in its occupation.
Just to insert a point there, it's not only students organizing around those lines of analysis, but there's an established line of scholarship
Oh, absolutely.
around
Absolutely.
those same
So
lines of analysis.
when you come out of that context, the fact that there is no mention of justice in statelessness, the nation state system. I'm not even going to say colonialism, but there's no context in which what's happening from the lens of the Palestinian is possible to be expressed in the hearings, because it's a hearing about anti-Semitism. And people were able, Democratic congressional leaders and the presidents of the universities were able to throw in words like Islamophobia here and there, anti-Arab hate. But by and large, there was no way, given how they were framed, to get at the historical situation that is bringing the students to the streets. So instead, when it gets framed exclusively around anti-Semitism, the Republicans can take the line that we're seeing, and they did, and there was, to a certain extent, this line was completely accepted and became a kind of truth within the hearing. That there's a huge scourge of anti-Semitism, a rise of very a resurgence of long-standing, long, you know, almost ahistorical, right? Ahistorical anti-Semitism. And there's literally no context in which someone can mention the Nakba. There's no context in which someone can mention what it's like to be in a refugee camp for generations. So all of that was erased, and could be precisely because of the way the hearings were staged as around anti-Semitism. And then the opening gambit by Representative Virginia Fox was to ask, as you mentioned, for loyalty oaths. She asked each of the presidents, "Do you believe in the existence of Israel as a Jewish nation?" I thought it was very interesting that the president, and I think it was Claudine Gay, who first kind of landed on as a kind of way to handle the fact that they were going to be gamed throughout. They were being gamed. And how do you answer these questions under that circumstance? She said, "I believe that Israel has a right to exist." So she didn't say, "I believe that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish nation," which is
Which
what she.
has over a century of controversy, including among Jews, around that.
Absolutely. Each president then just echoed what I believe it was Claudine Gay saying first. So they each had to sort of attest to the right of Israel to exist without any ability to contextualize the fact that there's many different imaginations around in what form it exists, whether it's established now, whether it was established in violence or whether it was established through the UN. There are people who would say it shouldn't have come into existence the way that it did, but now that it does, we have to deal with it as a reality and have, two-state system or whatever. To the two-state system, a binational, none of those terms. Palestinian, that term itself probably appears once in the entire transcript of the hearings. Before Fox asked for the loyalty oath, she asked for a moment of silence for the 1,400 victims. And then throughout the transcript, the Congress people who are trying to sort of gotcha to the presidents are mentioning babies being beheaded. They're talking about the women being raped. So the graphic violence of what happened to the 1,400 victims is repeatedly being invoked, and there's not one mention of the killing of innocent civilians in Gaza. And by the time of the hearings, I'm not sure what figure we were at in terms of how many people had died, how many children and babies and women had died in Gaza. I don't
Around
know.
15,000, but
There was not one mention of that.
can you say a bit about how you approach academic freedom?
In the culture wars, they're always conflated, academic freedom and free speech. So you have people, you constantly see them paired and not differentiated. But for the sake of sort of background that may or may not become important in talking about this issue in the hearings, academic freedom really speaks to scholars and professors and teachers' right to explore their and to develop their expertise, to not have the state politics or politicians not have money, donors, or the local chemical company that doesn't want the biologist testing the water in the area, to have all of those outside influences kept at bay. And allow the academics to pursue knowledge, pursue truth freely without coercion or interference.
Well, and of course, those forces are in play, and including in this very drama that followed.
The pressure from donors, the sort of, "I will withdraw billions of dollars of donations if you don't resign or if this isn't handled," that's enormous pressure. And of course, it's been a fantasy all along that tenure or the term academic freedom really buys you that kind of freedom from interference. But conceptually, it's very important. And there are at times different ways to create firewalls or at least to try to honor the principle that money should not buy knowledge or shape knowledge or in both regards, it shouldn't shut down knowledge. And nor should people be opportunists. This too is something that unfortunately is often practiced in the breach, which is the idea that we have salaries, so we don't need the chemical companies to pay us huge speaking fees to talk about how climate change is a hoax, right? That's the idea. It doesn't always play out that way. So while it's not ever been pure, and universities have always been shaped by both outside forces of the state, nationalism, and industrial, billionaires
Donors
and companies.
increasingly depend on donors as well as tuition money.
Yeah, it's absolutely been, at least with public universities, the shift has been from less and less federal and state subsidies and more dependence on donors and private interests and money. Yeah, so that's a big problem, and you want to disentangle speech that's been coerced. And so the problem becomes, and that's always been talked about in terms of the credibility of universities. So the fact that The presidents are being put in this position, like Liz McGill, where the board of trustees resigns and she resigns under the threat of money being taken back or withheld from the university, money that could go into all kinds of important and necessary and useful research. But the fact that those resignations happened under those kinds of threats and pressures raises questions on academic integrity, credibility of institutions. The integrity of the institution is supposed to be based in part on the, at least the, hopefully, the perception that it's keeping at bay special interests, and it's looking at the world objectively, and it's empowering its scholars to look at the world objectively. But so academic freedom speaks to the production of knowledge and the dissemination of knowledge. It also speaks to intramural and extramural speech, but that's, I don't think that's necessary to go into. Free
There are
speech.
responsibilities as well as rights that come, or freedoms that come with
Well, here's the difference. Free speech, First Amendment. The First Amendment and notions of free speech are completely predicated on the idea that we are a democracy in which the state should not be controlling its citizens' speech. The democracy only has legitimacy if citizens are able to criticize, able to dissent, able to offer their own opinions on issues, able to influence public opinion. So that a democracy re that's responsive to its citizenry requires free speech. The
And
other.
justification for the limits. And that seemed to be more what was at stake here in the hearings, rights of students, as I read it.
Well, but let me finish about the difference between the question where responsibilities come up is that with free speech, you don't want to put any limits except incitement to violence, except for threats, except for harassment, speech that is severe, pervasive. There's threats of harm involved. You can put limits on that, but the limits around the integrity of the speech, you can't put those kinds of limits on free speech. You can put them on academic freedom. So with free speech, the quality of the opinion, you can't control it. It's because you need citizens to be able to feel free to say if they want to spout a conspiracy theory, they can spout a conspiracy theory. If you have an academic, a historian of Germany who's spouting a conspiracy theory that the Holocaust is a hoax, you can fire that academic. That's not protected speech under academic freedom. If he's someone on the street corner, doesn't have a degree and isn't being sort of held up as an expert by an institution, he can say the Holocaust is a hoax and he can't be thrown in jail. He can't be thrown in jail as an academic, but he shouldn't be able to continue to teach either.
Yeah. So was this a displacement in a way by going after the most outrageous example of speech acts, a distraction from maybe the real issues on campuses around lines of scholarship, academic lines of scholarship that have been established that are critical of Israeli policies? And that they get swept into this, the moral panic of the return of calls for a Holocaust. You know, there really are a different set of issues that are more directly taken up now in academia about the scholarship of Palestinian studies, critiques
Well,
of Israel, and so on.
I think that takes us back to the question of to what extent is this an extension of narratives that have already been sort of aggressively pushed in the culture wars, and to what extent is this a new dynamic? Because if you think about before October 7th, what the right-wing politicians that it was most sort of flagrant and visible in Texas and in Florida, but there was legislative bills being proposed in senates and houses all over the country. But there was an attack on Black studies, ethnic studies, gender studies. There's an attack on identity politics, then the idea that, and there's a lot of language around it being divisive, a lot of language around these forms of study being tribal in some way and creating and polarizing and responsible for the polarization of America. I don't think any of that is fair at all. I mean, it would take a very, sort of Casaubon-like sociological study to map out all the reasons why we're in the state we're in America at this moment in relationship to being unable to sort of agree on some basic truths across differences. So I certainly wouldn't hold those departments responsible for them, but they were going after them, and they were going after them as unpatriotic, as causing discomfort for white students. So there were already these narratives, and then the transcripts of the hearing, you see. I mean, this is what I meant earlier when I said that sometimes you sort of admire the presidents for not answering one question because they can see how it's being set up for another. Repeatedly, Stefanik, but also others, repeatedly they say, now a call for a mass execution of African Americans on your campus would be a problem, right? Or a call for, they bring up race as in black, white, American race relations. So then one congressperson, not Stefanik, says, well, a neo-Nazi wouldn't be welcome on your campus, right? And the irony is that the neo-Nazi, it's as if they're saying it in the same kind of pattern that they've been setting up race relations in the states to then go after anti-Semitism, then sort of say you're a hypocrite because you have been controlling speech around race when it comes to African Americans. You've been supporting Black Lives Matter. You've been doing reverse racism, all of the stuff that we saw in the right-wing culture wars and the DeSantis stuff before October 7th. They're setting them up to sort of say, yeah, I have a problem with a neo-Nazi on my campus in the context of race. But of course, a neo-Nazi is also in the context of anti-Semitism and Charlottesville. So there's these weird twists and turns that happen. But what the president typically did was say, I would find those values against the institution's values, but we have a wide berth. Because they knew that the Congress people were trying to do is catch them in some kind of hypocritical moment. And they refused to be caught in that moment. But then it looked lawyerly, it looked cagey, it looked bureaucratic.
Well, I think it's refreshing to hear some praise for these beleaguered presidents, even though I'm sure they're getting paid well and will survive on that therapy. But it's also speaks volumes to people on the more on the periphery, academic periphery of these more elite schools. So I'd love to have you back on the Old Mole again as we continue to take this up and perhaps talk about the book coming out early next year, The Right to Learn, Resisting the Right Wing Attack on Academic Freedom. Can you just say briefly when that'll be available?
Yeah, it'll be out with Beacon Press in April.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we will definitely have you on the show. Thank you so much, Jennifer Ruth, for joining me today on the Old Mole Variety Hour to talk about the congressional hearings, holding campus leaders accountable and confronting anti-Semitism, and your insights on what that was all about.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give the fascist man a gunshot.
Enough is enough.
Give the fascist man a gunshot.